Hi, this is Al, and welcome to Open Chats with the Open Institute. The Open Chats with the Open Institute has one intention, for us to talk to eminent personalities in tech, in development, and in data, who can tell us what they think about the future of Africa and the future of our world. And this is season zero, in which we are featuring our new board members. The Open Institute has recently got new board members, and we are starting these conversations with them, to have conversations about what the world looks like with them, what life is like with them, and then from there we'll be able to take it forward. Now, on your screen there's a button that says subscribe. Please hit it. Make sure you also hit that little bell so that every time we have a new episode, you will hear about it and you'll be able to watch it. And in the comment section, if there's somebody that you think we should be featuring in this open chats, please let us know so that we can remember to reach out to them and call them. So today we are featuring somebody who is a scholar, somebody who has a multinational history that spans several countries, including Kenya, the United States, and South Africa, and who is a very big friend of the Open Institute. She's recently joined our board, and her name is Professor Geshe Karori. She doesn't like being called professor, but for this purpose, she is Professor Geshe Karori Sebina, and she's going to tell you about the dichotomy of her names and what they mean. Welcome to Open Chats.
Thank you.
And welcome to the board. Would you just start by just explaining your name?
Thanks, Al. So my name is Geshe Karori Sebina. Geshe is Wageshe, any good Kenyan will know that.
Yes.
Karori is my father's name, my late father's name. So he's originally from central Kenya, moved on to the Rift Valley, so that's a Kikuyu name. And Sebina is my partner's name. So it's a name from their families between Botswana and South Africa. So they're the Tswana people. Mm. It's a Tswana name.
Excellent. And you live in South Africa?
We live in Johannesburg, South Africa.
So tell us about what you do over there.
Okay, so what I do is more complex than it should be.
Isn't all our lives.
Yes. So my primary occupation right now is with the University of Witwatersrand, which is in Johannesburg. And I am at the Wit School of Governance, where I'm helping set up the Africa Center of Excellence in Digital Governance, which we've named Tayarisha. Very nice. Proudly.
Very nice.
So the Tayarisha African Center of Excellence in Digital Governance. I'm also linked to the school, so the usual teaching, supervision. So there's an educational mandate. Mm. But obviously, particularly being a school of governance, there's a big focus on what they call third mission. So what's the value we're adding to one of Africa's biggest challenges, which is right. Governance itself. Mm. So research, outreach, policy dialogue, building capacity beyond the university's traditional work.
Right.
Is a big part of what we aim to do through the center. Also to incubate. So we want to have a GovTech incubator that really focuses on building solutions for government, not just building the solutions, but making sure they gain traction within government.
So, but then what does incubation in this context mean? Because you'll notice that a lot of incubators have various definitions. Some of them mean just building capacity. Some of them mean actual setting up of an office space. What does it mean for you guys?
Thank you for asking that question, because you're absolutely right. And it's very clear to me that when we talk about incubation, it's not real estate incubation, meaning right. that it's just providing space for people to come and co-locate, which is useful. Mm. That's a particular kind. We actually have in South Africa something called the Gauteng Innovation Hub. We actually call it the Innovation Hub. Mm. But what it really provides is facilities and support to a whole range of different enterprises. And so the incubation really takes the form of linking them to infrastructure, linking them to support services, and there's a range of things that happen. That's not what we want to do. There will be physical space, there will be infrastructure, but that, in our view, is not the primary issue that we want to confront. What we want to confront is the ecosystem issue.
Right.
Is the fact that we have quite a vibrant private sector, we have a vibrant civic tech and sort of startup space in South Africa and in many African countries, actually. But often what you find, and I know this is a lot of what Open Institute deals with very well, mm. is that interface and how you can actually intersect into government is right. really poor.
Right.
It's poor because of capacity issues on both sides, I suspect. It's poor in our context in South Africa, for example, and I think maybe similar here to lots of procurement issues, sometimes issues of corruption, sometimes issues of mandates and who people think ought to do what. And so what we want to do is to say, look, we've got some really big governance and government challenges in Africa. How do we, in the GovTech space, so specifically public sector issues that are within the mandate of government, begin to look at how open innovation can actually contribute to that around a range of issues. So it may be an issue around the education system. It may be an issue around the science system. Who knows?
I mean, but then you know, lots of people, when they talk about innovation, what they sort of define it as is tech innovation.
Yes.
One of our other board members, Nivi Sharma, she does work in bridges.
Mm.
And building bridges somehow doesn't look like innovation in a lot of the African context speak.
Mm.
Is there room for us to kind of properly define or redefine innovation on our continent? Mm. But going a little bit forward, the rest of the world is producing big mega trend level innovation. So they're producers in AI, they're producers in robotics, they're producers in all these things that are going to affect our future long term. They're thinking about self-driving cars and so on and so forth. Are you aware of Africans who are doing, you know, mega trend level things? Or are we only just dealing with the software, you know, in terms of just, you know, building apps and that sort of thing, and then hailing those as great innovations?
And there's space for that too, right? So if we look at innovation more broadly, obviously the act of tech transfer and adapting existing tech to things you're doing is important. We ought to do that. I think it's sensible to use solutions where you don't have to reinvent the knife. If it's in the shop, just buy it and use it.
Yeah.
But it's not enough. I think you're absolutely right. So for me, the important caveats to what I mean by innovation when I speak on it, the one is, I don't think innovation is innovation if it's not solving the problems you actually have.
Right.
In fact, we're releasing a book this year that's called Solving the Problems We Have.
Mm.
We are of the view that there's a lot of what we tend to talk about as innovation that's almost tinkering. It's almost wanting to play in some global playing field and to be seen to be using the latest this or that, but it's not effectively solving the problem you actually have. So I think innovation has to do that, and it's part of the definition of what innovation actually means. The other thing that's important for me, besides that, the contextuality and the application to something, is that it can't only be the adoption. So to the point you're making, it can't only be about leveraging things you've seen elsewhere. There's a big part of it that has to do with imagination, creativity, and beginning to almost create and imagine things that are genuinely disrupting.
Right.
Disrupting not just through a black person doing something people didn't expect them to do,
right,
but disrupting in the sense of saying that we actually want to transform some of the problems we have, not just to be tinkering around with them. And I hope that's something we'll get to talk about actually in this conversation.
So you have spent, you know, like years, you know, thinking around the issues of innovation. You spent years actually doing the scholarly work of research and so on around the question of innovation. And for me, the question that I would have for you right now is, what are the big trends you've seen?
Mm-hmm.
See, a lot of the innovation that I have seen has involved building of apps and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of tech innovation in, say, the fields of education and health. And all of them were software. Little of them had impacts on some policy or some practices. Mm-hmm. But for the whole, they generally have meant you know, us doing some kind of software.
Mm-hmm.
What are the big trends that you've seen in Africa over the last, say, 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the big ones that you're seeing over the next 10?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess tech itself is an innovation trend. So if we're thinking about what have the big innovations been, frontier technologies obviously play a role, and that's what you're referring to. So there's a lot that's happened with the digital space, whether it's new understandings of data, whether it's redefining the mobility sector, you know, e-hailing and those sorts of things, whether it's really changing even traditional fields like agriculture in the sense of smart agriculture and what we're able to do now with Internet of Things or with new, you know, drones or whatever that really begin to change that space, the energy space as well. Often, in fact, in some of those, what I say is we've got some great examples, not enough. Our problems are at scale.
Yes.
And therefore, we need to get beyond having some cute case studies.
Mm.
And even those, I think we don't have enough of the cute case studies.
Right.
We've also got to get to where we are saying we've actually achieved food security somewhere because we've done these things. So technology itself, I think, is an important trend. But to what are other big trends that we need to look at? In Africa, you can't not speak about the demography.
Right.
And whether it's just the size and shape of our populations, and East Africa, Central Africa, West Africa is really where we're going to see a lot of that change, both in terms of the big population growth numbers, but also in terms of the age profile in particular.
How do you marry that, if I'm going to interrupt there, how do you marry that with the fact that there's a global labor shortage that is a megatrend? And that people are not actually seeing those jobs coming back. So the jobs are closing down, but people are not seeing post-COVID those jobs coming back. So you look at airports have constantly been short-staffed, especially the big airport hubs in Europe have had serious labor shortages, factories around the world and that sort of thing. But then here we have a very young population that's surging and there's almost no jobs enough to go around. How are you marrying all of that?
Well, I mean, some of it plays out on its own, right? So I think some of the issues we saw pre-COVID and indeed have sustained post-COVID are the migration things. People move. And whether it's rural, urban, which also for this belt of ours is going to be a big issue, countries like Kenya will continue to urbanize at huge rates and there are real implications of that. The southern and the northern parts of Africa, in a way, more or less urbanized over the past 2 decades. But I think in East and West, we are really going to see going from 30 to what? 60-70% urbanization. So Nairobi seems full now, just wait. But it's not just Nairobi, it'll be Nakuru, it'll be Mombasa, it'll be Kinangop, exactly. So I think that movement, whether it's just from rural areas to the cities or whether it's from the cities to the rest of the world, which causes a lot of concern elsewhere, is partly what we're going to continue seeing. From a labor and employment perspective, you know, obviously the other trend out there had been aging of population and they were very concerned about that. I think everybody thought machines would then do all the jobs, but apparently people still prefer real nurse to an AI sort of slash robot nurse. So I think there is still a need for physical labor, but there's a lot that we are going to have to, on a global scale, I think, deal with as well in terms of the social dynamics that go with that and the political. And it hasn't been easy. So we know that these movements of Africa into Europe or the US are not always smiled upon. Even within Europe itself, you know, try being Turkish, moving into Germany, and the hostility is real, or Romania, exactly. So I think the, and maybe that's another big mega trend, I think the geopolitics and how those play out both economically, but also socially and culturally, is going to continue to be something to really watch, I think, over the next 10 years. I mean, I'm not sure it's something I see getting better soon, even when I participate in policy conversations in Europe. Some of the attitudes are really surprising. So although, in my view, mobility is a thing people have always done, at one stage it was from Europe to Africa when they were coming to Alexandria and Timbuktu to learn from us. Now it's from us to them trying to find jobs. But I think there's always a hostility to that that you can't ignore because it bubbles under, it leads to particular protectionisms. And if nothing showed us that, it's COVID, right? I mean, we saw the vaccine nationalism and all of that. We are not all friends.
So let me ask you a somewhat self-critical question for a moment. Do you think the academy, the African academy, is doing enough to influence our thinking, given the socio-political, economic environment that we are in globally? Do you think that we are doing what we should be doing from an academy perspective? Like, are our scholars influencing our governance in the way that we would want them to, or in the way that they should?
I think there's two ways to answer that, because part of it might sound like you're talking about what is the quality of our scholars, right? And that could be part of the answer, because I suppose if they were not good, they would not be influencing. We have world-class scholarship in Africa. I mean, I'm mind-blown, quite frankly, at the caliber of academy that we have, of scholars that we have. You see it in the writing, you see it in the speaking. During COVID, one of the little statistics I saw that I actually wrote about is that we, according to WHO, in the first year of COVID, Africa generated about 12% of the really useful, like, gained traction technology that was used to address immediate issues. This is a continent that, according to the data, produces less than 1% of global knowledge in the shape of IP, publications, you know, the usual metrics. So what's the difference between that less than 1% and the 12% like that. That is probably a combination of formal knowledge that we have that resides in the academy that's probably not leveraged often, but also, of course, other non-academic knowledge and genius and creativity we have in terms of young entrepreneurs, young innovators, young technopreneurs. So I think we don't have a quality issue. I do think we have an issue. And so my answer to, is the academy doing enough to influence and to inform? No. That issue, in my view, has to do with two things. One, it has to do with the fact that our academy is constantly trying to survive itself. And so I'm in a university, we have science councils and big outfits, and they are all in survival mode. They're trying to figure out how to be relevant. They're trying to figure out how to sustain, whether it's the government budget they get in the form of subsidy or the fees that they secure from students, threats from international institutions, threats from new small fly-by-night institutions, trying to get the student numbers in there. So we're constantly competing, constantly, and then never mind individual survival, you know, professors or teachers who don't earn enough, and so everybody has their side hustle. So in my view, it's a very inefficient and probably a challenged space in and of itself. But of course, any advice or any input requires a receiving end. And I think there we struggle too. I used to joke that I worked in government for some time in South Africa. And when people would say in a conversation, oh, you're being academic, it wasn't a compliment.
Right.
We have a view of scholarship and academic work, particularly in political spaces, where we ridicule it, we almost make a joke of it.
Looks like it is impractical.
We want to make it look like it's impractical. We want to shun it because it's not probably assisting with what we actually want to do. And we used to joke about that all the time, that you're telling people what they don't want to hear, and therefore they'll find, whether it's by ridiculing or by ignoring, some way to not validate what you're saying. And I think we have that challenge in Africa. So if proximity mattered, so even Nairobi, where there was any campus of a university, people could clearly see that the neighborhood around there was better.
Yes.
You know, meaning that there's something diffuse, you know, either by physical presence or people presence, that means that where there is knowledge, things are better.
Yes.
I would be very happy, but that's far from the case, I believe.
Yes, in most places, in fact, their neighborhoods are really bad.
And that tells us something.
The question that I might ask you, what do you consider your life mission to be?
I used to think that my life mission was to work in big institutions to have the biggest impact possible through whatever knowledge, whatever skill I could garner. I used to believe that was my mission. I don't believe that anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you believe?
I think what I believe is I've come to realize that the bigger the institution, sometimes the bigger the problems. And institutions have a tendency to focus more on self-preservation than addressing the issues they're meant to be addressing. So the bigger the institution I'd find myself in, the more I'd find myself encumbered with institutional things, not with the thing we are supposed to be doing. And that I found very frustrating. So the distance to impact actually was greater and greater the bigger the institution was. I do think my premise was not wrong. I do think that at some stage our big institutions have to work. But at the level of what you can contribute to as a person, they're extremely frustrating. Often you find yourself surrounded by other frustrated people. And that takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of time. And I did that for probably a decade and a half. What I've moved to doing in more recent years, and maybe it's a factor of age. So I like to say to young people, you know, serve your time, because we do need people in these institutions. Yes. So go in there. You're not burnt out yet. Fight the good fight. Believe you can do it. And maybe you will. And that's what
I
believe.
Maybe you'll change something.
Maybe you'll change something. At some stage, when you get to being a little bit jaded and you realize actually you're just going to work and looking at people, you know, and just earning a salary, I think it's a good time to leave and to see what you can better do. And I think I've been going through that. And what I now believe to be my mission is to find those small spaces where I can actually contribute something useful. And if it's a small thing, we manage to move this cup from here to there and we do that well, I think that's a really good thing. The other thing I happily make time for, and I think nobody will be able to claim otherwise, is I make time for young people.
Right.
I make time for young people because I remember being young and full of hopes and dreams and not always having the audience or the support or the belief in you. And, you know, young people, you're young. You can be pretty foolish as well. You don't know very much. But I think at that stage where people have energy and where people have not just energy, but faith that they can do something, and all they need is 1, 2, 3, and those are things that those who are already sitting on the other side can offer. I feel like that's a calling that I have. So I spend a lot of time either mentoring young people or just being there, you know, passing on opportunities. I get asked to speak a lot, and now I often divert those to others. I say, rather talk to that person. They have more interesting things to say.
Yes.
Sometimes about also a little bit of path correction where you can see people going off. I love supervising in the academic space. So in my formal work, that's something. Anytime I'm asked to speak to young people, I'll be the first there. And it's not because I think I have a lot to teach them. I think I have a responsibility to encourage them.
Right. So, why did you join the board of the Open Institute? And when you attended the board meeting, there must have been something special that you heard that jumped out at you. What is this thing that inspires you the most?
I've come to believe in instinct and energy. And so a lot of it initially had to do just with you, actually, Al. That we engaged in the context of the civic tech world and talking about these things. And I felt an energy, a vibe, you know, in terms of the work you were saying you're doing.
Yes.
I felt, you know, this sounds like something I can get. Remember, my belief is I just need to move cups from A to B. So I felt, okay, here's somebody who is really moving things from A to B, and that I can get behind. So that was really exciting to me. At the point where I was invited to join and began to meet the others, the fact that it's in Kenya for me is homegrown. This is home for me. That's really exciting. I really believe, and in a way similar to this mission we have with Tayarisha, that a real space for intervention is exactly in how citizenry can be activated. Not trained or taught necessarily, but enabled to really own the agency they have. And new data, new tools allow us to do some of that, but to address that interface with these big institutions I'm talking about. So to some extent, I think the model, the thinking of Open Institute is something I really believe in. I believe I can get behind. I believe a lot in endogenous institutions.
Right.
And so I think the fact that this is Kenyans doing something for Kenya is really important to me. And then, as I mentioned earlier, this idea of hypercontextuality is something I really believe in. I love so much that the focus of work in OI is not initially just working in Nairobi, Mombasa, and maybe Kisumu.
Yes.
That when you talk about the examples, I'm hearing about Malindi, I'm hearing about Lanet, I'm hearing about Kajiado.
Yes. That's
really important to me. So even though I'm a, you know, I did urban work for a long time and I tend to speak about big places because big places have big problems, those problems are not unrelated to the fact that we tend to undervalue, underestimate everything else. You know, the whole system matters if you were to think about ecosystems. So I really value that about the approach of OI. So for me, I believe the board is a space where I will gain a lot just by being around, you know, just absorbing, I think, the energy of people, the ideas of people, but also where I think I can contribute. I've been in the space of innovation and futures for a long time. I'm hoping I can bring a little bit of that, both domain experience, but also maybe external experience into what we're trying to do here. And also everybody seemed really fun. And I'm growing old, so I have to be around things that are fun.
Fun and hopeful.
Exactly, exactly. I don't want to be depressed.
Final question, and this one is a debate that's currently raging in my office. Some of the older folks in the office are saying there's no such thing as working smart, that you must work hard first, and then after that you'll figure out how to work smart. What's your position on this? Work hard or work smart?
There's a part of me that's just kind of experience, right? Like what I've lived through and what I've lived through as a young Kenyan and then being out in the diaspora as a fairly young person is working hard always mattered. And I remember reading a lot of articles actually about how research shows, as an academic, I have to talk about research. Research shows that hard work trumps talent any day. So they've tracked kids where they've shown the kids who were super smart, you know, just like little child geniuses. By the time you fast forward to 30 years later, the person who worked hard almost always does better than the person who was just smart to begin with or just had some natural inclination. I think you can't trump hard work. Of course, you can be working hard at the wrong things.
Yes.
And so I think that also matters. Working smart, I think, is possible if you assume you know what working smart means. I'm working with a lot of young people who I think they like to think they do. And I'm almost always able to prove them wrong. But, you know, I'm also an old fogey, so
yes.
so I don't want to have debates with people. Do what you like. But it's, I think it could easily be both. And so, but I do think you can never trump working hard. At some stage, something's going to happen where the hard work is going to pay off, and you just have to put shoulder to.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that we at the Open Institute kind of pride ourselves in. We are often accused of doing too much. We are often accused of being accused of stretch, because we do tend to work hard, and the reason for that is that we have a big mission. We have to find a way to make sure that as many people as possible become responsible and own the development of their spaces. And there you have it. That was Geshe. We had a great conversation about many things, including whether scholars are contributing as they should to the governance problem, or whether they're being absorbed well enough into the governance problem. But this is just one of the conversations that we're going to be having over the next few weeks. And if there's someone that you think that we should be featuring, please tell us in the comment section. If there's things that you agree with that Geshe said, we can't wait to hear what you think. And thank you so much for paying attention to us, for being with us. Just make sure that you hit that subscribe button and make sure that you tell a friend to tell a friend to tell a friend that this Open Chats exists. Thank you and have a good one.